page, which you can find at bbc.co.uk/radio3/NGA. That's it from the New Generation Artists today. I'll be back on Friday at 9 p.m. with more pianistic brilliance, this time from Christian Ela Hadland. I hope you'll join us then.
And that was Clemency Burton-Hill. This is BBC Radio 3. It's just gone 2:45, and now live from the Royal College of Music, we've Proms Plus, presented this afternoon by Sarah Moore-Peach.
Hello. Thank you very much, Jonathan. Welcome to the College of Music, and welcome to this Proms Plus event looking at the epic Les Troyens by Berlioz, which we're going to be treated to later on in about just under 2 hours' time from the Royal Albert Hall. We're going to follow through the five acts and plot out this epic story in this Proms Plus event, and also point to some of the musical threads that you can listen out for in the performance. And I have a helpful guide next to me, delighted to welcome Sarah Lenton, who works for the Royal Opera House, also E&O and Glyndebourne, and is a resident opera expert. Sarah, thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you.
A little later on, we'll also have another guest joining us here on stage at the Royal College of Music, fresh from the final rehearsal, which is happening right now across the road in the Albert Hall. A member of the Covent Garden Chorus, John Morrissey, will be coming to tell us a little bit about what's been involved in putting a production like this together. Sarah, Berlioz's Troyens, I sort of think of, at least from my encounters with it, as almost two operas strung together by the presence of Aeneas, which might be a slightly dangerous place to start. But certainly it's in these two sections, the first of which takes place in Troy, the fall of Troy, and the kind of central character is Cassandra, who foresees the downfall. And then we move to Carthage and to Dido, and the linchpin is Aeneas. What do you think was in Berlioz's head when he put an opera of that scale together?
Berlioz was destined to write this opera. He was taught Virgil by his father, and very famous occasion when he's 12, they're going through the death of Dido in the poem, and suddenly little Hector's little chest goes up and down, and he can't speak. And his father puts the book down and says, "That's all right, my boy, we'll stop the lesson." And he sees the child is completely overcome by the death of Dido. And Berlioz writes in his memoirs, "I rushed out of the house to indulge my epic grief."
We shan't ask how. So clearly had a huge impact on this young boy.
Yes, and here it is, it's his last work, culmination of a whole life's devotion to Virgil and to Dido. And a wonderful, although he's a great romantic, so Dido takes over eventually, he's true to Virgil. His father taught him well. And you'll see or hear tonight how we start with the fall of Troy, just as Virgil does, and we end with new Troy being built at the very end of the show, and Dido, as she has to, retreats. So it's a wonderful tribute to Berlioz's passion for Dido, but his absolute artistic integrity too, and his love of Virgil.
Well, we'll get to Dido at the end and in the second part of this. Let's start where we begin with the whole thing. Not an actual overture at all, but certainly a kind of heraldic opening. And really rather brave of Berlioz only to use the winds. The very first thing we hear is basically just woodwind. You don't get any strings, which is quite unusual.
Everything Berlioz does is unusual. The French thought he was bonkers. And when it started, I imagine, back in the 1860s, they thought, oh, he's done it again. Where's the overture? So you go straight into the Trojans. Can't believe it, the Greeks have disappeared.
So what we'll hear is the very opening, and you get this ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba sort of heraldic opening, and then underneath you'll hear a second melodic line, which is a rising scale. Let's hear that. Very peculiar opening for an opera.
Astonishing. What are the chorus doing? Ah, ah, is there outside at last? The Greeks have gone. We can breathe the fresh air again. I couldn't believe it, although I was expecting it when I went to the opera house, and there they all were. like that, breathing on stage. And did you hear the little pipe, a little shepherd's pipe, a little drone? At last, pastoral sounds and the woodwind, always with Berlioz, of course, but giving us the fields, which they haven't seen for 10 years.
The key character who we meet quite soon in is Cassandra. And, you know, it is her destiny that she can see what's going to happen in Troy. She knows that it's not going to end well with the Trojan horse, and nobody believes her, not even her partner, which is, you know, terribly sad in a way to watch. And her music is doom-laden as well. When we meet her, Antonio Pappano, in a lovely film which the Royal Opera House made, introducing the music, talks about the kind of French overture style of Cassandra's music. So I thought before we hear the music which introduces Cassandra, I'd explain a little bit about what a French overture actually is. It's this kind of French style that goes back to the Baroque, very stately, and lots of composers use it, and so I've picked out a couple of very familiar ones. The first of which is the overture to Handel's Messiah. And what characterizes this French overture is a double dotted rhythm, bum, ba-bum, ba-bum. So let's have a little listen to that. So, familiar music, and that's a kind of French overture style. And here's another one, which you might recognise from the Goldberg Variations by Bach. This is the overture in a French overture style variation. This is a string trio arrangement, just in case anyone is expecting to hear a harpsichord. So you have that wonderful flourish, a kind of stately entrance of kings and queens. That arrangement by Dmitri Sitkovetsky of the 16th of the Goldberg Variations by Bach. So now let's hear the music which introduces Cassandra, which brings both of those elements together, that flourish up the scale and also the double dotted rhythm. The entrance of Cassandra, sung there by Berit Lindholm in the Colin Davis recording with the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden. So Cassandra predicts the Trojan horse and the fall of Troy. Nobody listens. She pleads with her lover, Coroebus, to leave Troy, but he refuses. And the Trojans all rejoice that the Greeks are leaving. There's one person who mourns, that's Andromache, who's mourning the death of her husband, Priam's son. And then we get the chorus of Trojans. Sarah, Berlioz writes this chorus fantastically, doesn't he?
I find this whole unit amazing in Berlioz. His roots are Greek drama and French classic drama. He understands that. You've just heard Cassandra declaiming the great tragedy queen. And any Greek drama, you're going to expect a chorus. And wonderfully in opera, you can do choruses, and this is emphatically the chorus opera of all operas. And suddenly the chorus are with us. But this isn't happy peasants. These are people who've been through 10 years grim war. They're a proud people, and you get this astonishing somber music as they come in, joyful but measured.
In the chorus that we're about to hear, they're singing to the gods who watch over their city, and they're offering incense to the gods. Mm. And what's extraordinary here, I think, is that Berlioz manages to get the major and the minor squashed in together so that you can barely tell the difference between the two. One moment you think you're hearing a triumphant wedding march, the next moment doom and gloom, and absolutely the last 10 years of horror that they've been through. Let's hear that chorus of Trojans. Extraordinary. He takes us up a major arpeggio, and then just at the end he turns it minor again, and it's rather affronting, actually, as a listener.
Yes, I'm astonished at how brilliantly he gets processional music and outside music. I mean, he was used to doing bands and processions, but that mixture of big drum and brass and military, it's military, they're still a military nation. And over and over again in this piece, the orchestral writing is so pictorial. It almost directs itself, though I'm sure Sir David McVicar wouldn't agree with me.
Well, you and I have just been in to a little bit of the rehearsal before we started this talk and heard some of that music, actually,
yes.
That chorus.
Yes.
And it's wonderful also to be able to see not just the chorus standing there, but also the whole orchestra, and to, in a sense, follow the instruments in a way that normally with the opera, we don't see them there in the pit, and our attention is elsewhere.
Ah, yes, and in Berlioz, you suddenly see the trombones move, and you think, oh, my God, and the drumstick gets up, you know, yes, Berlioz's moment is coming any minute. Yeah.
There was also, for those of you here at the Royal College of Music who are going across to the Albert Hall to see the prom later, and you'll also be able to hear this on Radio 3 when we broadcast it, there's also a rather splendid set of bells which stand in front of the organ. Tell us about those.
That's the Jingling Johnny. It is. And we have several Jingling Johnnies at the Opera House, and this is one of the big ones. And it's got lots of sort of very big... If you can imagine a gigantic noddy, the sort of bell he might have on his hat, stuck on a triangle, a wooden triangle, and then on a pole, and you play this very difficult instrument by banging it very hard in time. And Papano smiled as it happened, and he said, I've got one of those at home, he said.
And when it appears, what do you think it means?
It means unpitched instruments. It means we're dead primitive. And it means, Berlioz is saying, you see, the Trojans, they lived a long time ago. And this is the sort of instruments they had.
You mentioned Berlioz's sense of the dramatic and bringing outdoors music indoors. Mm. There's a wonderful moment for offstage band where essentially the kind of action is happening somewhere else. The Trojans are being primitive and not listening to Cassandra at all, and they're off doing their marching.
Horse, yes.
And that happens off stage, and on stage you see Cassandra, and so in a sense we're with her and her kind of horror as she hears what's happening but can't seem to do anything about it. An amazing moment, that off stage.
Yes, there's something like 22 off stage instruments, and that's a lot to cram into the wings and backstage. And what is amazing is, you know, those idiots are pulling in that damn horse. And she knows it, and she's got the strings know it too. So Cassandra and the strings going, this is really bad news. But the brass band in the wings, they're just coming closer and closer. It's a wonderful dramatic moment. It can't not work. You don't need to stage that. That's going to work wonderfully. this evening in the Albert Hall.
Let's just hear a little snippet of that offstage band. So Act One ends with poor Cassandra and her horror and the Trojan horse debacle unfolding somewhere in the distance. Act Two begins sort of on the outskirts of Troy in Aeneas's palace. Now, Aeneas is an absolutely central character in this, and this is the first time we meet him. And he's not doing anything besides standing there thinking, I ought to do something.
No, he's in bed, bless him. But he's in bed because he's got to have his dream. And Aeneas is a marked man, absolutely marked man, and Hector appears and says, OK, Troy's going, but we're going to have a new Troy, and you are to heroically remove yourself from the battle, which is even braver, you know, because it looks like you're running away, really, and escape and found new Troy. And from that moment onwards, Aeneas is a marked man, a dedicated man, but a man who'll never lead a normal life.
He's on his way to Italy. That's
the
where
new
he has
Troy
to go.
Is going to be founded in Italy, just by the Tiber. And when you know that Virgil was the court poet to Augustus Caesar, you might see a connection, of course. But it is no, Virgil didn't make that up. It is a connection that the Trojans apparently founded their new city in Rome. And Jupiter only allowed the destruction of Troy because he knew that new Troy would appear on the Tiber and be even more wonderful.
Wouldn't it be nice if we all had that sort of foresight? Then the action goes back to Troy again, and Cassandra and the Trojan women, who are playing lyres, and indeed the harp sort of appears quite a lot, doesn't it?
Women do, that's what women play. And anyway, if you're going to sing, you must have a harp, because you can't play a reed instrument or something like that. And wonderfully, as Cassandra joins the women, and the worst has happened, Cassandra, who's, you know, the normal way of talking about Cassandra is she's a prophet of doom, oh, she's a Cassandra, whoa, 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 if anybody can remember Frankie Howard and Up Pompeii. But no, actually Cassandra is a realist. What she's saying is true. And she's cursed with the fact that she can see the truth. And funnily enough, when the worst has happened, Cassandra, who is a realist, is rather comforting. She comes, you know, yeah, it's happening. Yes, I can see what's going on. Now I'll tell you what to do.
Well, there's a bit of music that I want to play just here, which is when Cassandra is about to die.
Yes.
And the doom and destruction is all going to...
I was throwing the ball back.
Well, let me throw it back to you very briefly, and then we'll hear a little bit
Cassandra's
of music.
Cassandra's great idea is, look, guys, we're dead. Why don't we just kill ourselves now, keep our self-esteem, and we're women. I mean, the women would not be killed, actually. They'd be dragged off into slavery and that sort of humiliation. We will be Trojan women to the end, and we will kill ourselves. And the women, or most of them anyway, say, yeah, you know, this is one way out. And they go into the most ecstatic chorus as they work themselves up, psych themselves up for this sacrificial death. So in an astonishing way, they win. The Greeks are aghast as they see the women commit suicide. And Cassandra, Berlioz's noble virgin, dies heroically, as he felt she should.
You told it much better than I could have done. Thank you. So just a little bit of music to listen out for. Remember when we heard the very beginning, the bit that wasn't an overture, and we had that ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba and the rising scale? Well, at the moment that it's all about to happen and Cassandra and her women are about to commit suicide, this music comes back in, and this time the sort of counter melody, as it were, is going down the scale instead, as though we know it's all about to fall. Can we just hear that?
Cassandra, come along.
There, and it is a rather extraordinary end. Let's just hear the death of Cassandra and that final moment. We'll hear about a minute or so of it and listen out for the final cry of Italy, which in a way is going to throw the ball on to the next act. The close of Act Two of Berlioz's Les Troyens, and that's the Colin Davis recording with the chorus and orchestra of the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden. Well, we're going to talk about the second part, as it were, in just a moment, but I'm delighted to say that a member of the Royal Opera House chorus, who's just a couple of moments ago finished rehearsing across the road in the Royal Albert Hall, joins us. Please welcome John Morrissey. John, hello. Look, you're clutching your vocal score.
I am. It's very thick.
To say the least. Absolutely. How are rehearsals going?
Oh, really, really well. It's an enormous place, so the acoustic can be quite boomy. So we've been doing a lot of work on making it very sharper and more staccato, so it doesn't become a big blur, basically. So.
Does the acoustic change when the audience is in there? Because, of course, the whole ground of the Albert Hall gets...
It does.
People to soak up some sound.
It definitely does. But even making allowances for that, it still can be quite a very boomy acoustic. So, but it sounds amazing. And it's such a thrill to stand there and look out at those seats that I've sat in so many times. It's only my second time ever doing a prom, so the other one was Boccanegra.
So you have, I have the impression anyway that it's the sort of space that Berlioz would have rather enjoyed getting his hands on and, you know, and dealing with some of those issues.
Definitely. Bigger the better was Berlioz's. He was always trying to get as many people as he possibly could to do everything, so I think he would have approved.
Sarah, you think he'd have liked the
Albert Hall? Oh, loved it. Absolutely loved it. I mean, he can be filigree if he wants to, but, I mean, give him a big space and he fills in.
Yeah. John, what's it like being involved in a production like this, not so much at the Albert Hall, but in the Opera House? Is there an awful lot going on behind the scenes?
A massive amount. I don't know if any people out there have seen it, but it's spectacular is the word. But we started rehearsing the music way back in November, I mean, before Christmas, because we usually have about four or five operas at the same time. So there was a realisation that there was an awful lot of music involved in this and we needed to get on with it as soon as we could. But yes, I mean, I sometimes think with a lot of productions, if people could see what was going on backstage, it would be maybe not as entertaining, but equally as entertaining as what's going on the stage. There's an awful lot. There's dancers. There's a giant horse, which I'm sure you've seen. A giant man, metal man. There's fire. There's an awful lot going on. It's huge.
And what's going on behind the scenes for you? Because you guys aren't just one set of people. You're several sets of people, the chorus.
We are Trojan Chiefs, and from Act 3 onwards, we're Carthaginians as well. And most operas get more easy as they go along. Usually the soloists take over. In this opera, it gets more complicated for us because one minute we're Carthaginians. Literally the next 2 minutes we're Trojan Chiefs. Then 2 minutes later, we're back to being Carthaginians again. So there's a lot of quick changes. There's about five quick changes back and forth into the same costume towards the end, running on stage, swords, Italy, running off again, Carthaginians. It's long robes, beards off.
And
it's a bit of a marathon.
Is that something you enjoy, or do you wish that it was a little calmer and you were less of a key role? Because in a way, the chorus is absolutely vital to this work.
Yeah, I definitely enjoy it. The dress rehearsal, possibly the word enjoy I wouldn't have used. That was a bit of a nightmare. But once you get used to the timings and you realise how long you've got, it's usually longer than you think, then you can really start to enjoy it. And it's in terms of length, it's about the same length as Lohengrin, but Lohengrin has about the same amount of music in as well. It's possibly the hardest chorus opera. But in this, there's an awful lot of running about as well, whereas in Lohengrin, you don't tend to do a huge amount. Whereas this, there's racing about, climbing up enormous sets. So it's far more physically exerting as well.
So the Albert Hall's a walk in the park, really. Just get to stand
there.
Yeah,
we get to sit down, which is great.
Well, let's hear one of the wonderful chorus moments. This is the very beginning of Act 3, and we're now in Carthage. And the backstory is that Carthage has been around for about 7 years. And Dido and her people fled to the African shore and founded Carthage. Now it's built, and they're all celebrating. And the chorus is praising Dido. This is Gloire à Didon. Wonderful walking bass line, that, isn't it? Sarah, this is very, very different chorus writing to what we heard earlier.
Oh, this is happy. And that's the Carthaginian national anthem, that is. And in the old English translation, they used to sing Dido, happy and glorious. And when you listen to it again, you'll curse me for that, because you'll hear that. It goes beautifully with the French. Glorious moment. Comes back over and over again. Can't come back too often. What's it like to sing?
It's amazing. It really is. And I'm very high on the Opera House set, so I'm almost level with the balcony. So it just feels like you're sort of singing out. And it's very personal to her as well. David McVicar wanted the anthem to be very personal to her, not just a generalised national anthem. Mm. He wanted to show how much we love Dido. And it's a very loving community that this warlike sort of body of people come into. So he tried to get away from the whole God Save the Queen type thing and make it more of a tribute to her sort of thing.
What then happens is that having sort of celebrated Carthage, then news comes that a whole bunch of others have turned up, and they are Aeneas and his band on their way to Italy, stopping off in North Africa, as you would. And then the news that Carthage is under attack, and Aeneas, whom Dido welcomes into Carthage, offers to fight and help, which is a very noble thing of him to do, being the noble chap he is.
He is the epic hero, and his great line in Act Two is "Je suis Aeneas." I haven't got much French, but even I knew what that meant. But the thing is, you've got to be the epic hero so you can say, "I am Aeneas," and carry everyone with you. And the wonderful thing about the opera and the production is that when he says it, you think, yup, it's Aeneas, we're okay. And the music all calms down, doesn't it? And you think, great, he's going to win, obviously.
And he uses his own name in the bit of music we're about to hear now. This is, because I thought we really ought to hear Aeneas' voice. This is him, he brings his son with him. And when he decides to go off and fight with Dido's soldiers, he leaves his son in Dido's care. And he sings a rather lovely aria to his son, essentially saying, Daddy's going off to war. But he says, keep in your mind the image of the heroes Aeneas and Hector. So he already has his own sort of himself as hero, you know, there for his son to see. And there's no sort of shame in that at all.
No, but he says to his son, I can only give you two things, love of valour and piety to the gods. And you think, yep, that's the pious Aeneas. That is the Virgil hero.
Let's hear him. Real hero, and Sarah, as you say, very calm music as well. There's a great presence in it. The use of strings, I think, particularly there. Mm. Berlioz allows the orchestra to kind of fully support Aeneas.
Yeah, this isn't just an operatic hero. This is one of the great European heroes. He's the son of Venus. He's a demigod himself. He carries his own gravitas with him.
And he helps them win, which is what happens between the acts. So then we come on to Act 4, and if you know Purcell's Dido and Aeneas, as I'm sure many people do, then this plot is quite easy to follow. There's a big royal hunt scene, and then Dido and Aeneas retire to Dido's garden by the sea, and Anna, who's her sister and Dido's advisor, Nabal, have a little gossip. He's a little worried that Aeneas is going to have to leave, and Anna's like, no, it'll be fine, don't worry, they're in love. And then, just as an aside, there's a series of entertainments, one of which is, I think, really interesting and worth just hearing a little bit of. It's a dance for Nubian slave girls. And the sound world here is, I would say, utterly exotic. But, Sarah, you had a sort of different word for it.
I said cute native tune, really. But it's deliberately ethnic. And shall I describe it before you hear it?
Please, yes, yeah.
What you're going to hear are sort of North African flutes. I mean, not that they are. Of course, it's shawm, isn't it, you discovered?
Sort of, yeah, gaita, which is a rather kind of harsh-sounding reed instrument that they use in North Africa.
And unpitched instruments. You see, if you have unpitched instruments, that means primitive or ethnic. And pentatonic, you know, the black notes of the piano, which always, you can't help it, it always sounds primitive if you play that. Or Turandot, you know, or Butterfly when she sings. You always have these black notes because it is the sort of naive, primitive sound. And so suddenly, we have this artless Nubian slave moment. But I think it's all part of ballet diverts that you get in French opera. You've got to do a load of ballet. And the obvious thing is to have people come on in national costume and do little cute things.
Let's hear a little bit of that musical colour then, the North African Nubian slave girls.
Amalume, mi donare.
just an example of a completely different sound world we suddenly drop into and then out again. Aeneas then goes on to tell Dido about the fate of various Trojans, and in particular she hears that Andromache, who's Hector's widow, has married Pyrrhus, the man who killed Hector, which kind of lets her off the hook because Dido, as a widow, feels guilty about the fact that she's falling in love with Aeneas, and somehow this gives her license to take up with Aeneas. And then they sing this wonderful love duet. And I thought we'd hear a big chunk of that duet, because my feeling is that the better you know these great tunes in opera, these great love duets and arias, the more delicious they are when you hear them yet again. Set us up for that, yes,
can
please.
I just put a word in, yeah. Just before that love duet, which I'd never heard before, I'd heard the love duet before, there is an octet, I think it is, with the chorus, which is equally beautiful. It's the most extraordinary piece of music. It's so sensuous and leads straight into that love duet. But I'd never heard it before, so look out for that.
And it's absolutely Berlioz ramping up the...
It sets it up. By the time you've got the duet, we're all in love. It's a beautiful African night. The stars are shining. We've had the octet, this wonderful sensuous music. And then the lovers at last sing together.
Here they are. The glorious Act IV love duet between Dido and Aeneas, sung there by Josephine Veazey and John Vickers in the Royal Opera House recording under Sir Colin Davis. Sarah, Shakespeare seems to be quite important to Berlioz. He writes about that duet as a kind of Shakespearean duet, and there's a deliberate allusion in it.
Yes, Berlioz went back to the Enchanted Garden at Belmont in Merchant of Venice for that, used the same form Lorenzo and Jessica talk about, on such a night, this and that, certain lovers. And they talk about the Trojan, Troilus, leaping over the wall to see Cressid. And they also say, and it was on a night like this, that Dido stood on the shore with a willow in her hand, trying to waft her lover back. So if anybody knows their Shakespeare and realises what he's quoting, you think, oh, this is not what you want to sing in the love duet with Aeneas. But he changes the words, obviously, to make them suitable for the plot, but it's a wonderful double illusion there. And he felt that Shakespeare and Virgil were just behind him while he was writing all this. And apparently, while he was writing, he'd look up and talk to either Will or Virgil. And he'd say, is that right, master? And he said, I know I'm being stupid, but I feel they're right behind me.
There is also something, I think, rather Shakespearean about the beginning of Act V, in that it's all about the subplot. And Shakespeare's subplots are so absolutely wonderful. And you get these two, sadly we don't have time to hear them right now, but we will look forward to them later on. There are these two wonderful moments. First of all, Act 5 begins with a sailor who has nothing to do with the plot really at all, appearing and singing this wonderful song to the sea. And then you have a couple of Aeneas's chaps who are sort of saying actually how nice they're finding life in Carthage. Yes. And they've got women on the go there and they don't really want to leave at all. So there are these wonderful sort of colouring subplot moments that set the scene for the final disaster, which is, of course, that Aeneas goes.
Well, Dido is his last temptation. Stay here and be normal like your sentries want to be. But no, Aeneas knows he's the gods are pushing him. Five ghosts appear, so that's quite heavy. And they tell him to go as well. And Berlioz does his best for him. He gives him a fantastic aria where he's absolutely torn, but ultimately he's got to do his duty. And he does his best, but he does leave. And as he leaves, all our sympathies go straight back on Dido at once.
And, I mean, Berlioz absolutely loved Dido, as we heard earlier. There's a wonderful letter which he wrote to the Princess Sayn Wittgenstein while writing this, saying, "Would you believe it? I've fallen in love, utterly in love, with the Queen of Carthage. Oh. I adore her, this beautiful Dido." As, of course, under the Carthaginians.
Yeah, yes. And we know Ava very well anyway, so we're all in love with her anyway. So it's not very difficult to adore her on stage. Because I don't know if anybody of you saw Anna Nicole, slightly different show, but she was our Anna Nicole Smith, so very different opera. But no, she's a lovely person, so we just look down at her, look at her face, and you don't really have to act very much.
And at the very end, you cry out a curse on the Trojans, Carthageans, because, yeah, of course, Dido has killed herself dramatically on the funeral pyre.
Yeah, and it's sad, really, because in contrast to how we sing at the beginning of Act 3, where we all love each other and love everybody, suddenly they've learnt to hate and learnt to be this aggressive, warmongering society, and that's a real shame for them.
Before Dido dies, she sings a wonderful farewell to her proud city of Carthage, raised, as she says, by selfless toil. Let's hear some of that and notice how, a little way through, similar music from the love duet comes back again.
Thank you.
And so Berlioz's Dido says farewell to her beloved city of Carthage. And so we must say farewell here too at the Royal College of Music. Thank you for joining us. Huge thanks to John Morrissey and Sarah Lenton for being my guests. Do join us live for Berlioz's Les Troyens in an hour's time from the Royal Albert Hall. Now time for me to hand you on to Jonathan Swain in Broadcasting House.
Sarah, thank you very much. Sarah Moore-Peach there at the Royal College of Music, and 4:30 starting time for the Trojans. As for a good many of the rest of the week's proms, well, a composer whose music Berlioz was very familiar with.
The 2012 BBC Proms. 9 symphonies that changed music forever. On Radio 3, Daniel Barenboim conducts the Beethoven symphonies at the BBC Proms. The cycle continues throughout this week and culminates next Friday on the opening night of the 2012 Olympics with the composer's hymn to universal brotherhood, the Choral Ninth. Beethoven, conducted by Barenboim at the BBC Proms. Continuing tomorrow night with the Pastoral and the Fifth Symphony at 7:30 on BBC Radio 3.
This is BBC Radio 3. It's just gone 3:30. And time now for Choral Evensong, which is a recording of a service which took place last Wednesday in the chapel of Eton College with the second of this year's Eton Choral courses. The 12-part Magnificat was composed by Andrea Gabrieli in the 16th century for St Mark's in Venice, and the Nunc Dimittis by Heinrich Schütz is from his Musikalische Exequien, music written in 1636 for the funeral service of a German prince. The anthem is Claudio Monteverdi's 10-part setting of Psalm 127, Nisi Dominus, from his Vespers of 1610. Except the Lord build the house, their labour is but lost that build it. And the service opens now with an introit, also by Monteverdi, Cantate Domino, sing to the Lord a new song.
Welcome to Eton College Chapel for this service of Evensong. We are delighted you are able to join us. God is spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth.
As it was in the beginning, is now,
appointed psalms are Psalms number 93 and 94.
Ever since the world began, and thy seed came in man, thou art for. first lesson is taken from the book of the prophet Isaiah, chapter 33, beginning at the second verse. O Lord, be gracious unto us. We have waited for thee. Be thou their arm every morning, our salvation also in the time of trouble. At the noise of the tumult, the people fled. At the lifting up of thyself, the nations were scattered. And your spoil shall be gathered like the gathering of the caterpillar, as the running to and fro of locusts shall he run upon them. The Lord is exalted, for he dwelleth on high. He hath filled Zion with judgment and righteousness. And wisdom and knowledge shall be the stability of thy times, and strength of salvation. The fear of the Lord is his treasure. Behold, their valiant one shall cry without. The ambassadors of peace shall weep bitterly. The highways lie waste. The wayfaring man ceaseth. He hath broken the covenant. He hath despised the cities. He regardeth no man. The earth mourneth and languisheth. Lebanon is ashamed and hewn down. Sharon is like a wilderness, and Bashan and Carmel shake off their fruits. Now will I rise, saith the Lord. Now will I be exalted. Now will I lift up myself. Here ends the first lesson.
The office hymn, Love Divine, All Loves Excelling.
Thank you. second lesson is taken from St. Paul's letter to the Philippians, chapter 1, beginning at the first verse. Paul and Timothy, the servants of Jesus Christ, to all the saints in Christ Jesus which are at Philippi, with the bishops and deacons, grace be unto you, and peace from God our Father, and from the Lord Jesus Christ. I thank my God upon every remembrance of you, always in every prayer of mine for you all, making request with joy, for your fellowship in the gospel from the first day until now, being confident of this very thing, that he which hath begun a good work in you will perform it until the day of Jesus Christ. Even as it is meet for me to think this of you all, because I have you in my heart, inasmuch as both in my bonds and in the defense and confirmation of the gospel, ye all are partakers of my grace. For God is my record, how greatly I long after you in all the bowels of Jesus Christ. And this I pray, that your love may abound yet more and more in knowledge and in all judgment, that ye may approve things that are excellent, that ye may be sincere and without offense till the day of Christ, being filled with the fruits of righteousness, which are by Jesus Christ, unto the glory and praise of God. Here ends the second lesson.